The following is a special report. From Washington, CBS News presents the appearance of the Apollo 11 astronauts before a joint meeting of the Congress. The Astronauts in Washington is sponsored by Western Electric, manufacturing and supply unit of the Bell System, as part of their continuing coverage of important news events. Here is CBS News congressional correspondent Roger Mudd.
This joint meeting with the Congress was originally scheduled for last Wednesday, but had to be postponed because of the Dirksen funeral services. It's been almost 2 months now since the astronauts landed on the moon, and public and congressional enthusiasm has naturally diminished somewhat. So today's joint meeting in the House chamber will not only permit the Congress to salute the astronauts for the first time, but also will help renew interest and attention in the space program. We shall be seeing astronauts Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins in just a moment.
The laser beam. It was still just a gleam in the eyes of scientists until 1965, when engineers at Bell Labs and Western Electric became the first to put the laser on the job in industry. The job? Piercing holes in industrial diamonds to make thin telephone wire. Today, Western Electric uses the laser to cut material for thin film electronic circuits. We also use the laser to measure and to weld tiny parts for equipment we make for the Bell telephone network. Someday, the laser beam may transmit telephone calls and other data. Someday, you may find yourself talking over one. Western Electric. We make Bell telephones. We were also the first to put the laser beam on the job in industry.
The applause in the House chamber is for the Nixon cabinet, which has just entered prior to the announcement that astronauts Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins have arrived. Now being seated in the front row in the well of the House is the Nixon cabinet. Of course, the diplomatic corps will be here today, and the astronauts' wives and the full complement of space program officials. If memory doesn't fail me, this is the first joint meeting of the Nixon administration, so this is the first picture we will have had of Vice President Agnew sitting parallel with Speaker McCormick. Joint meetings, joint sessions, of course, have to be held in the House chamber simply because the Senate chamber is too small to contain 435 congressmen, even though all of them never show up, plus 100 senators, plus diplomats, plus judiciary, plus cabinet, plus joint chiefs of staff, plus wives. And as you can see on your picture there, some of the members have brought their children onto the floor.
Mr. Speaker.
Mrs. Fishbait Miller, the
Apollo
scorekeeper.
11 astronauts.
This is Armstrong, the civilian, followed by Aldrin and Collins, two Air Force colonels. Of course, they wear their civilian clothes to de-emphasize any military aspect of the program. Taking hands with the Speaker and the Vice President. This is the first chance that the Congress has had an opportunity publicly to recognize the great accomplishments of this astronaut team. Many of these members, of course, were down at Cape Kennedy for the launch of the Apollo 11. This is the Nixon cabinet, Senator Strom Thurmond, Republican, obviously pleased. Really, this is one issue on the Hill that everyone can applaud. It does not create the immediate controversy. This is Richard Russell whispering to Mike Mansfield, standing directly behind Secretary of State Rogers. Edward Kennedy, the assistant Democratic leader of the Senate. Now the Speaker, John McCormick.
My distinguished colleagues of the Congress, we are honoring today three men who represent the best in America and whose coordinated skill, fantastic daring, and visionary drive have made history that constitutes a turning point of paramount importance in the journey of mankind. I have the high honor and official and personal pleasure of presenting to you the crew of the Apollo 11 who successfully made the historic journey to the moon, Neil A. Armstrong, Colonel Edwin E. Aldrin, Jr., and Lieutenant Colonel Michael Collins. Chair recognizes Mr. Armstrong.
Mr. Speaker, President, members of Congress, distinguished guests, we're greatly honored that you have invited us here today. Only now have we completed our journey to land on, explore the moon, and return. It was here in these halls that our adventure really began. Here, the Space Act of 1958 was framed, chartering document of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And here, in the years that followed, key decisions that permitted the successive steps of Mercury and Gemini and Apollo were permitted. Your policies and the marvels of modern communication have permitted people around the world to share the excitement of our exploration. And although you have been informed of the results of Apollo 11, we're particularly pleased to have this opportunity to complete our work by reporting to you and through you to the American people. My colleagues share the honor of presenting this report. First, it's my pleasure to present Colonel Edwin Aldrin.
Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, it is with a great sense of pride as an American and with humility as a human being that I say to you today what no men have been privileged to say before. We walked on the moon. But the footprints at Tranquility Base belong to more than the crew of Apollo 11. They were put there by hundreds of thousands of people across this country, people in government, industry, and universities, the teams and crews that preceded us, all who strived throughout the years with Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. Those footprints belong to the American people, and you, their representatives, who accepted and supported the inevitable challenge of the moon. And since we came in peace for all mankind, those footprints belong also to all people of the world. As the moon shines impartially on all those looking up from our spinning Earth, so do we hope the benefits of space exploration will be spread equally with a harmonizing influence to all mankind. Scientific exploration implies investigating the unknown. The results can never be wholly anticipated. Charles Lindbergh said, "Scientific accomplishment is a path, not an end, a path leading to and disappearing in mystery." Our steps in space have been a symbol of this country's way of life as we open our doors and windows to the world to view our successes and failures, and as we share with all nations our discoveries. The Saturn, Columbia, and Eagle, and the extravehicular mobility unit have proved to Neil, Mike, and me that this nation can produce equipment of the highest quality and dependability. This should give all of us hope and inspiration to overcome some of the more difficult problems here on Earth. The Apollo lesson is that national goals can be met where there is a strong enough will to do so. The first step on the moon was a step toward our sister planets, and ultimately toward the stars. A small step for a man was a statement of fact. A giant leap for mankind is a hope for the future. What this country does with the lessons of Apollo applied to domestic problems and what we do in further space exploration programs will determine just how giant a leap we have taken. Thank you.
Now I should like to present Colonel Michael Collins.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of Congress, and distinguished guests. One of the many things I've very much enjoyed about working for the Space Agency and for the Air Force is that they've always given me free rein, even to the extent of addressing this most august assemblage without coaching, without putting any words into my mouth. Therefore, my brief remarks are simply those of a free citizen living in a free country and expressing free thoughts which are purely my own. Many years before there was a space program, my father had a favorite quotation. He who would bring back the wealth of the Indies must take the wealth of the Indies with him. This we have done. We have taken to the moon the wealth of this nation, the vision of its political leaders, the intelligence of its scientists, the dedication of its engineers, the careful craftsmanship of its workers, and the enthusiastic support of its people. We have brought back rocks and and I think it's a fair trade for for just as the Rosetta Stone revealed the language of ancient Egypt, so may these rocks unlock the mystery of the origin of the moon, of our Earth, and even of our solar system. During the flight of Apollo 11 in the constant sunlight between the Earth and the moon, it was necessary for us to control the temperature of our spacecraft by a slow rotation, not unlike that of a chicken on a barbecue spit. As we turned, the Earth and the moon alternately appeared in our windows. We had our choice. We could look toward the moon, toward Mars, toward our future in space, toward the new Indies, or we could look back toward the Earth, our home, with the problem spawned over more than a millennium of human occupancy. We looked both ways. We saw both. And I think that's what our nation must do. We can ignore neither the wealth of the Indies nor the realities of the immediate needs of our cities, our citizens, or our civics. We cannot launch our planetary probes from a springboard of poverty, discrimination, or unrest. But neither can we wait until each and every terrestrial problem has been solved. Such logic 200 years ago would have prevented expansion westward past the Appalachian Mountains. For assuredly, the eastern seaboard was beset by problems of great urgency then, as it is today. Man has always gone where he has been able to go. It's that simple. He will continue pushing back his frontier, no matter how far it may carry him from his homeland. Someday in the not-too-distant future, when I listen to an Earthling step out onto the surface of Mars or some other planet, just as I listen to Neil step out onto the surface of the moon, I hope I hear him say, "I come from the United States of America."
We landed on the Sea of Tranquility in the cool of the early lunar morning. The long shadows would aid our perception. The sun was only 10 degrees above the horizon. And while the Earth turned through nearly a day while we stayed, the sun at Tranquility Base rose barely 11 degrees, a small fraction of the month-long lunar day. There was a peculiar sensation of the duality of time. The swift rush of the events that characterize our daily life and the ponderous parade which marks the aging of the universe. Both kinds of time were evident. The first by the routine events of the flight whose planning and execution were marked by fractions of a second, and the latter by the rocks around us, unchanged through all the history of man. and whose 3 billion year old secrets made them the treasure we sought. The plaque on the Eagle summarized our hopes and bore the message, here men from planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 A.D., we came in peace for all mankind. Those 1969 years had constituted the majority of the age of PCs, a 12th of that great year that is measured by the 1,000 generations the precession of the Earth's axis takes to scribe a giant circle in the sky. The next 20 centuries, the age of Aquarius, the age for which our young people have such high hopes, humanity may begin to understand its most baffling mystery. Where are we going? The Earth is, in fact, traveling many thousands of miles an hour in the direction of the constellation Hercules, to some unknown destination in the cosmos. And man must understand his universe in order to understand his destiny. Mystery, however, is a very necessary ingredient in our lives. Mystery creates wonder, and wonder is the basis for man's desire to understand. Who knows what mysteries will be solved in our lifetime, and what new riddles will become the challenge of the new generations. Science has not mastered prophecy. We predict too much for the forthcoming year, yet far too little for the next 10. Responding to challenge is one of democracy's great strengths, and our successes in space lead us to hope that this strength can be used in the next decade in the solution of many of our planet's problems. Several weeks ago, I enjoyed the warmth of reflection on the true meaning of the spirits of Apollo. I stood in the highlands of this nation near the Continental Divide, introducing my sons to the wonders of nature and the pleasures of looking for deer and for elk. In their enthusiasm for the view, they frequently stumbled on the rocky trails. But when they looked to their footing only, they did not see the elk. To those of you who have advocated looking high, we owe our sincere gratitude, for you have granted us the opportunity to see some of the grandest views of the Creator. And to those of you who have been our honest critics, we also owe a debt of thanks, for you have reminded us that we dare not forget to watch the trail. We carried on Apollo 11 two flags of this union that had flown over these halls, one over the House of Representatives, one over the Senate. It's our privilege to return them now in these halls, which exemplify man's highest purpose, to serve one's fellow man. We thank you, on behalf of all the men of Apollo, for giving us the privilege of joining you in serving for all mankind. Thank you.
I think we would be remiss on this occasion if, and in paying the highest honor that the Congress can pay to any person to invite them and to receive them in joint meeting, to also to honor the what might be termed the unseen astronauts, the wives of our distinguished friends. I'm going to ask the wives of the astronauts to rise. Mrs. Armstrong, Mrs. Collins, Mrs. Collins.
Of the members of the Senate, we are very grateful for the presentation of this flag. We watched with great interest the Apollo program proceed. We're conscious of the thrust of the need of the words of the gentleman who spoke here this morning. The primary need being balance, the need to meet the problems of our society, wherever they arise. I can assure you that this memento will not fall into that category, but will be kept and appreciated with the dignity that it deserves. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the House of Representatives, I want to express our sincere thanks to the members of the Apollo 11 for the thought and for the action in carrying this flag presented to the House, to the moon, and flying it on the moon. These two flags are probably two of the most precious flags, not only of our own country, but of any other country. We extend to you the deep thanks of the members of the House of Representatives, and to assure you that every care and caution will be taken, because this it will be forever one of the most treasured possessions of this great chamber.
The three astronauts have scored, obviously, a success with this Congress. This is the first time that the astronauts have had the opportunity to thank Congress for the money it appropriated. This is standard performance by all the astronauts to come back to the Congress after a major flight or mission and give praise to the appropriations procedure of the Congress. They're shaking hands as they go out, being led up the center aisle by a Senate and House Sergeant at Arms, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Tunsey. And this is Congressman Miller of California, who's chairman of the Space Committee on the House side. And you'll see as they walk up the center aisle, members of the Congress grabbing at them, shake their hands. Speaker McCormick should be under no illusion about the flag he accepted on behalf of the House of Representatives. It did not actually fly on the moon. It was just taken up there. And, of course, the presentation of these two flags to House and Senate was a master stroke by the astronauts, because the Congress does have a thing about flags. They fly them over the House and Senate when each chamber is in session, and they, one flag is flown over the east front of the Capitol at all times. And flags are given away on Capitol Hill just for the asking. So the astronauts knew when they brought these flags back how much they would mean to the members and the leaders of the Congress. Now, this is probably the space program's newsiest week in more than a month, with today's joint meeting on Capitol Hill, a report yesterday, a preliminary examination of the rocks brought back from the moon, and the release of the recommendations of President Nixon's special task force on space. Dan Rather, the CBS correspondent at the White House, is here, and we're going to get his report on Mr. Nixon's views toward space after this announcement. We'll ask Dan Rather now about the president's views on space.
Roger, the president has decided that the United States should attempt to land men on Mars, but that we should not embark on any crash program to do it. He has rejected two extreme recommendations, one calling for an immediate effort to put a man on Mars just as soon as possible, the other calling for complete elimination of manned space exploration. Mr. Nixon has opted for the middle ground, commitment to a Mars landing, but one to be accomplished in the 1980s at the earliest. Thus, the U.S. space program for the 1970s will include additional men on the moon, unmanned exploration of all the planets, and development of a huge orbiting space laboratory with large crews of men aboard for many months.
And you heard today on the Hill, Vice President Agnew rolling back a little on his early demand for a crash program to Mars. For Dan Rather, this is Roger Mudd, CBS News, Washington.
This special report came to you from Washington, where the Apollo 11 astronauts have addressed a joint meeting of the Congress. The Astronauts in Washington has been sponsored by Western Electric, manufacturing and supply unit of the Bell System, as part of their continuing coverage of important news events.